Penguin Random House Audio presents Devil's Cut by J.R. Ward. Read for you by Alexander Sendes. Note from the author. It has been such a privilege to write about my adopted home state, its proud history of bourbon making, and these wonderful, complicated, and sometimes broken people who live and work at Easterly. This series was born of my old-school love for the television show Dynasty, fueled by my deep reverence for Kentucky, and directed by my fascination for how people and families evolve through stressful times. As a New Englander who was transplanted from one commonwealth to another, I had a hard adjustment in the beginning. Now, well over a decade later, I can truly say that I can't imagine living anywhere else but here. The NCAA basketball tournament is happening right now, for example, and I have a huge TV set up in the foyer with six sofas and coffee tables arranged around it. The entire house is dismantled, and yesterday, a big crowd of friends was screaming and yelling at the games. There was also a boxing match in the basement during one halftime that resulted in a busted lip, as well as ping-pong grudge matches that were nearly as bloody as the boxing. This kind of devotion to a college sport would have been unthinkable before I moved here. And what a joy and sorrow it is to me. My beloved Cardinals did not advance. The making of bourbon requires time and temperature. After the nascent alcohol is put into the charred barrels, it is stored in uninsulated conditions in the rack houses and left to interact with the caramelized sugars of the oak over the heat and the cold of the seasons. This dance and the alchemy that ensues is what gives bourbon its beautiful color, and is part of how it gets that special taste. I've often thought the process is analogous to the way places, people, and various eras in our lives affect us, tempering our core characteristics, emphasizing certain traits, bringing forth our strengths, or highlighting our weaknesses. My two favorite terms of art from what I have learned about bourbon making and its traditions are the angel's share and the devil's cut. Roughly speaking, about 53 gallons of White Dog are put into each barrel. But at the end of the aging process, much less than that actually comes out. This loss can be upward of 2% per year and happens due to evaporation, the angel's share, but also absorption into the oak of the barrel, the devil's cut. What this means is that if you age a bourbon for, say, 10 years, you may get around 43 gallons out the other side. And the longer it stays in there, the less you have on the far side. For example, some of the oldest Pappy Van Winkle, which has aged for 23 years, yields only 14 gallons of bourbon at the end of its rack house days. The angel's share is a romantic-sounding term. The devil's cut, something more sinister, although that is really because of the D word. In both cases, they refer to the environment owning a piece of that which is within it. In my situation, when I came down here, I never expected to like Kentucky, and I certainly wasn't interested in being influenced one way or the other by anything about it. Now, if God forbid I ever had to return to life in Boston, I would most certainly leave a piece of my soul in the land of the bluegrass. And you know, that seems only fair, given all the good that has come to me here and all the wonderful people I have met and things I've enjoyed. But again, I have no intention of going anywhere else anytime soon, God willing. I have absolutely loved writing these three books, and I thank you for taking some time for your life to have a stroll in through Easterly's grand front door and walk around her beautiful, complicated rooms. I'm so grateful I got to do this series. Oh, and go Cards! J.R. Ward. 1. Easterly, the Bradford Family Estate, Charlemont, Kentucky. There was someone trespassing down in the garden. In the lazy, hazy southern night, beneath the flowered, tasseled fruit trees, and between the saucer-sized tea roses and the squads of trimmed boxwood hedges, a figure was inside the ivied walls, moving over the brick paths, heading for the back of the mansion like a stalker. Jonathan Tulane Baldwin squinted and leaned closer into his bedroom window. Whoever it was, they were in a crouch and sticking to the shadows, and the efficiency with which they chose their way suggested they knew what they were doing and where they were going. Then again, it wasn't that hard to find a 20,000-square-foot white birthday cake of a house in the dark. Turning away from the wavy old glass, he looked to his bed. Lizzie King, the love of his life, was deeply asleep in the pillows, her blonde hair gleaming in the moonlight, her tanned shoulder peeking out from the silk sheets. Funny, these moments of clarity, he thought, while he pulled on a pair of boxer shorts. As he considered who it might be and came up with nothing good, he realized without a doubt that he would kill to protect his woman. Even though she could take care of herself, and he felt like he was relying on her now more than ever, if anybody tried to hurt her, he would put them in a grave faster than his next heartbeat. With that resolve, he went silently across the oriental rug to an antique bureau that had been in his family since it had been made in the 1800s. His gun was in the top drawer on the left, under the rolls of finely woven socks he wore with his tuxedos. The 9mm was compact, but it had a laser sight, and it was fully loaded. He disengaged the safety. Letting himself out into a hall that was as long as a city street and appointed with all the grace and formality of the corridors in the White House, he kept the weapon down by his thigh. Easterly had 20 or so family and guest bedroom suites under its prodigious roof, and as he passed by doors, he counted who was inside, or should have been. His younger sister, Jen, although not her new husband, Richard, who was away for business. Amelia, Jen's 16-year-old daughter, who had yet to go back to Hotchkiss for finals. Jeff Stern, Lane's old college roommate and newly appointed CEO of the Bradford Bourbon Company. And then, of course, Lane and Jen's mother, little Virginia Elizabeth. It was possible that any of them could be down there for a 2 a.m. stroll. Well, except for his mother. In the last 3 years, little V.E. hadn't been out of a room for anything other than his father's visitation mere days ago. And even though that occasion had warranted the effort, seeing her dressed and on the first floor had been a shock. So it was unlikely it was her. And as for staff, the butler had quit and none of the maids stayed overnight. Well, the maids had all been let go anyway. No one else should have been on the property. Halfway down the hall, he walked through the second-story sitting area and paused at the head of the formal staircase. The security alarm was not going off down below, but he hadn't put the system on when he and Lizzie had gotten home from the hospital. Dumb. Hell, had he even bothered to lock the 1,000 or so doors on the lower level? He couldn't remember. It had been nearly midnight, and his brain had been a mess. Images of Miss Aurora and that ICU bed tangling him in knots. Dear Lord, that African-American woman was more his mother than the Neo-Daisy Buchanan who had birthed him, and the idea that the cancer was taking Miss Aurora away from him organ by organ was enough to make him violent. Descending the grand stairs, which were right out of Tara's playbook, he bottomed out on the entry foyer's black-and-white marble floor. There were no lights on, and he stopped again and listened. As with all old houses, Easterly talked when people moved through its rooms, its beams and boards, hinges and handles, conversing with whoever walked around. Nothing. Pity. Kentucky law provided a homesteader defense if you killed a trespasser in your house, so if he was going to shoot somebody tonight, he'd prefer to do it inside rather than out. That way, he wouldn't have to drag the body through some doorway and arrange things so it looked like the son of a bitch had been breaking in. Continuing on, Lane went through the shadowy rooms in the public part of the house, the antiques and old paintings making him feel like a security guard checking a museum after hours. Windows and French doors were all around, bracketed by great swaths of vintage fortuny, but with the lights off throughout the first floor, he was as much a ghost as whoever in that garden was. In the rear of the mansion, he went to one of the doors and stared out across the flagstone terrace, searching through the wrought-iron loungers, chairs, and glass-topped tables, seeking that which did not belong or was in motion. Nothing. Not around the slate skirt of the house, at least. Somewhere out in the greenery, however, a person was stalking his family. Turning the brass handle, he gently opened the door halfway and leaned out, the mid-May night embracing him with warm, heavy air that was fragrant as a bouquet. He looked left, looked right. The gas lanterns that ran down the back of the mansion threw flickering light.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?